Hello, I'm David Harper with the BBC News. Tens of thousands of people have fled Sudan's largest refugee camp in Darfur after RSF paramilitaries took control following days of violence. According to the UN Refugee Agency, 13 million people have been displaced across Sudan. Camilla Mills reports.
Zamzam refugee camp used to provide a temporary home to 500,000 people, many of whom are facing famine-like conditions. The fall of the camp has upended their already precarious existence. Doctors Without Borders says 10,000 civilians fled not just the camp, but the region to the town of Tawila, more than 70 kilometres away. It's not known how many travelled the shorter distance to the regional capital, El Fasher. News of the attacks comes on the eve of the second anniversary of the start of Sudan's civil war.
Hungary's parliament has approved constitutional changes which target LGBT people. It comes after the Prime Minister Viktor Orban vowed to block the annual Pride parade in Budapest. LGBT demonstrators are gathered outside the parliament, as Nick Thorpe reports.
The governing Fidesz majority have voted by a large majority to approve the 15th Amendment to the Hungarian constitution. That limits the right of assembly on the grounds that the annual Pride demonstration, which in the governing party's view popularizes or portrays LGBT, homosexual, trans people, and that endangers children.
A court in Washington has been told that Meta bought up Instagram and WhatsApp after its attempts to compete with the platforms failed. The US Federal Trade Commission is suing the tech giant for anti-competition acquisitions. The company's founder, Mark Zuckerberg, is reported to have personally lobbied President Trump to drop the case. Here's Lily Jamali.
In court on Monday, the regulator said those acquisitions unlawfully quashed competition in the social media space and, quote, protected Meta's dominance. Meta says it has significant competition in social media, including from TikTok and X, formerly Twitter. And the FTC signed off on the acquisitions back when they took place.
Pope Francis has placed the celebrated Catalan architect Antoni Gaudí on the path to sainthood. He's been declared venerable in recognition of what the Vatican said were his heroic values. Here's Danny Eberhard.
Upon his death nearly a century ago, a contemporary called Antoni Gaudí the architect of God. Many of the millions who've seen the soaring towers and vaults of the Sagrada Familia have agreed. It's been described as a Bible in stone and has been recognised on UNESCO's World Heritage List. Gaudí, who was a devout Catholic, would need to be beatified and then canonised to become a saint. Each of those steps require the Catholic Church to verify a miracle attributed to him.
World News from the BBC. The Washington Post has revealed that American weapons were used by militants in last month's deadly train hijacking in Pakistan. The newspaper traced the serial numbers of some of the rifles used in the attack on the Jaffa Express in Balochistan to the factory that produced them in America. The guns were among billions of dollars worth of US military equipment provided to Afghan forces. Three teenage students have died in Tunisia after part of a wall in their school collapsed. Two other pupils were also badly injured in the incident in a high school in the Sidi Bouzid region in central Tunisia. Tunisia's biggest trade union has called for a strike to be held in schools on Tuesday, both in mourning and in protest against what it called failure by the authorities. Scientists say new research indicates that a combination of two low-cost drugs could treat and save thousands of heart attack patients. Studying 36,000 victims, the British and Swedish teams found that giving statins and the cholesterol-lowering drug ezetimibe within 12 weeks of the heart attack produced better outcomes. Patients are at greatest risk of suffering a new heart attack in the first year after the initial event. A six-woman crew has returned to Texas after an 11-minute rocket flight to the edge of space. The American pop star Katy Perry could be heard cheering as the Blue Origin rocket, owned by the Amazon owner Jeff Bezos, blasted off. She talked about the experience afterwards.
It's about a collective energy in there. It's about us. It's about making space for future women and taking up space and belonging. And it's about this wonderful world that we see right out there and appreciating it. This is all for the benefit of Earth.
High-profile travellers are intended to maintain public interest in Blue Origin's work as it competes with rival firms such as Virgin Galactic for a slice of the fledgling space tourism sector. And that's the latest BBC News.
I'm Mark Thomas, a retired union activist. Tune into the Access Hour Monday at 7 p.m. when I'll interview Mary Englem and Annie Havel about their experience as politically active working class women. Workers' history by people who lived it on the Access Hour Monday at 7 p.m. on WRT Madison. When we stand hand in hand, that's the power, that's the power that must rule in every land. One industrial union brand. Oh, would you have meant?
6 foot six above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take it to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places.
Welcome to A Public Affair. I'm Douglas Haynes, your Monday host. Last month, the United States Department of Agriculture, the USDA, eliminated two programs that help schools, child care centers, and food banks buy food from local farms. This cut erased more than $1 billion in support for child and family nutrition and farmers. A USDA spokesperson stated that the support for feeding people local produce, quote, no longer effectuates the goals of the agency, unquote. These programs were part of a Biden administration effort to boost financially strapped school nutrition programs and farmers during the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, schools, child care centers, food pantries, and food producers are scrambling to account for the loss of federal support. Today on A Public Affair, I'm joined by three experts on school nutrition and farm-to-school programs to tell us about the real impacts of these Trump administration cuts at the USDA. Erica Krug is farm-to-school director at Rooted, a nonprofit based in Madison. Erica supervises a gardener-in-residence program that provides garden-based education at Madison Metropolitan School District schools and works to connect local farmers to school districts in order to get more local food in school meals. Welcome to A Public Affair, Erica.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we also have with us Caitlin Torjainen, who is child nutrition coordinator in the Ashwaubenon, Wisconsin School District and president of the School Nutrition Association of Wisconsin. Welcome, Caitlin.
Thank you. It's really great to be here.
We're really glad to have you. And we're also glad to have back on the program Dr. Jennifer Gaddis, who is associate professor of civil society and community studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's an expert on school food policy and advisory board member of the National Farm to School Network. Welcome back to A Public Affair, Jennifer.
Thanks, Douglas. I'm delighted to be here with you all.
And I want to welcome all of you listening today. If you have a question or story to share about farm to school and school nutrition programs, please give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. We'd really love to have lots of community perspectives in the conversation today. That's 608-256-2001, extension 9. So, Erica, we're going to start with you today. And have you just orient us a little bit, tell us about what farm to school means and what the different aspects of farm to school are.
Sure. So when we talk about farm to school, we really say that it's a movement. And we also talk about the three main components of farm to school. So the first one is procurement, meaning that we're working to get local foods into school meals. So purchasing foods from local farmers that are then used in school meals or part of a snack program or in taste tests. The second component of farm to school is school gardens. So engaging students in hands-on garden education at school sites. And then also the third one is education. So students participating in educational activities related to agriculture, nutrition, and health.
Great. And while we're with you, do you want to tell us a little bit more about what this looks like here in the Madison Metropolitan School District and what Rooted does to support farm to school?
Sure. So at Rooted, so as we mentioned, Rooted helps to maintain a gardener in residence program. So we work in partnership with 13 schools in Madison through an AmeriCorps farm to school program and a gardener in residence program. And at those sites, we have garden educators that are providing garden-based lessons and cooking clubs. We also provide garden programming at several sites around the city. So we have the Madison School Farm on the east side where we work with Kennedy Elementary School. And so every Kennedy Elementary School student gets to take a field trip to the school farm in both fall and spring. And we also host other schools around the city at that site. We also have the Troy Kids Garden on the north side where we do programming. And then also at Badger Rock Middle School, we have garden classes with that middle school there. So that's really the heart of our farm-to-school programming is that hands-on education where we get kids outside. We get their hands in the dirt. They're learning about how to grow food, and they're growing food, and they're tasting it. And then we also have been working to get more local foods into school meals. A couple of years ago, we heard Josh Perkins on your program here, and he said he was interested in more local foods and school meals. So we gave him a call, and he was also interested in school gardens. So we worked with Josh, and we did a project where we grew lettuce at a few of our schools in the classroom, and then we transplanted it to the school farm, harvested that lettuce, and then that was incorporated into lunches for elementary school students. Another way that we work for getting more local food into school meals is through a USDA Spark grant that we currently have that has been really farmer-focused, and we've been hosting listening sessions and a workshop where we bring farmers from the southern Wisconsin. We brought farmers from southern Wisconsin together with school food service directors to meet one another and to connect them to really just start to build capacity for schools in southern Wisconsin, and particularly Rooted, we're focused on MMSD ways to get more of local food into our school meals here.
Thank you, Erica. Yeah. That gives us a little bit of a sense of what this kind of funding supports.
Sure.
And obviously, we're going to get some examples from Caitlin and Jennifer here in a few minutes from other places as well. But I wanted to make sure listeners understand exactly what we're talking about here when we talk about farm to school. So, Caitlin, we're going to turn to you now and have you start with maybe also what you see happening farm to school wise in your district and your area there in Brown County, up around Green Bay. And then also we'll have to turn, of course, to those cuts. But tell us what's happening first, and then we'll talk about the threats after that.
Sure. So farm to school has been just a huge movement in our programming and our school nutrition community, and also in our Brown County area that we live in. We've had a farm to school task force for probably 15 or so years, and have actually had a lot of our farms come together to form an LLC where, you know, we go online and we order, maybe I'm ordering 500 pounds of cucumbers and I might get 100 pounds from one farmer and 10 pounds from a different farmer, and at the end of the day I just need that 500 pounds. I don't care which farmer they're coming from, but I can make one phone call instead of making 10 or 15, which has been fantastic. So we are really big into serving fresh local foods as often as possible, but I think what's really important to note, particularly for school districts, that we only have about $2 that we can spend on each meal that we provide to students. So obviously we want to serve fresh local ingredients as often as possible, but our budgets are so tight that we kind of have had to pick and choose over the years. Okay, which day am I going to put something local on the menu and which day am I not?
So I think that that is a good bridge for us thinking about now what the loss in federal funding might mean for districts, given that schools have, like you said, around just $2 a meal to make a lot of great food happen for kids. Tell us a little bit of an overview, Caitlin, as you understand it, of what the programs that were cut last month are and what they have done to support students and farmers and schools.
Yeah, so the programs that were cut were the LFS, the Local Foods for School funding, which included child care centers as well, and then the LFPA, which was Local Foods for Food Pantries. And again, when we go back to that $2, so essentially what was happening was the government was paying the farms to sell us their food, sell it to us free to the school district so we could get healthier foods into the bodies of students. The quality is unmatchable. The nutritional value of these local foods is so much higher than some of the nutritional value that we're getting from the USDA in our prepackaged items that we receive from our commodity dollars. So I believe it was about $11 million total to the state of Wisconsin over 3 years. I think $6 million of that was for schools, and anyone else on the call can correct me if my numbers are a little off, but it was somewhere in that $6 million, $11 million range.
Okay. Jennifer, we'll turn to you to give us a little bit more of the national context to build on what Caitlin just told us. What are you learning about the impacts of these cuts now around the state and around the country?
Yeah, I appreciate what Caitlin and Erica have shared so far. I would say that there are really two primary populations when we're thinking about who this impacts. So one is the students who are eating the food, for sure. But the other is all of these farmers and other food producers who were really starting to expand their businesses or, you know, looking for ways that they could get their good, nutritious food to not just be going to farmers markets or to restaurants where maybe they could get like a price premium, but to people in our communities who are most food insecure. So that's food pantries, as well as children who would be participating in the school meal program, because while it's open to all students, we know that it disproportionately feeds students from families that qualify for free and reduced meals. So I think it's not only that children are being impacted by having less access to nutritious food, but also some of these farmers were really, you know, expanding their businesses in different ways, you know, purchasing new kinds of equipment, developing new kinds of supply chains, and now are having to scramble to figure out what they're actually going to do to make their businesses functional. And it may be that they're able ultimately to make, you know, some sort of financial sense out of this, but it's not necessarily the values orientation or the movement to really build strong, local, resilient food systems that so many people were really excited about, especially this opportunity to get their food into places that can't always afford to pay them the price that they need to break even. So I think it's just a really sort of missed opportunity to be supporting our rural communities who are producing food and making sure that they're able to feed people in their communities who might be priced out of the market for some of their goods.
Yeah, Jennifer, just to follow up there, the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction, I've read, is saying that more than $11 million could be cut from free and reduced lunch programs throughout the state as a result of these cuts, bringing more families to local food pantries for help. What's your sense of the impacts on food pantries and just food security or insecurity more broadly, especially for families with young children?
I think we're in a really challenging time because not only are we seeing the changes that you just mentioned, but also potential really huge changes at the federal level to SNAP eligibility. And I think that puts more and more pressure on people to be figuring out how they actually get access to nutritious food. So if we have less nutritious food that people are able to purchase through SNAP benefits, but also less nutritious food available to families through food pantries and through schools, I think that that is really a big step back. And to me is also very counter to the goals of the whole Make America Healthy Again movement. It's been interesting to see at the national level with school food policy how there are actually a number of bills all across the United States. Wisconsin is one of them that are essentially trying to ban a number of different food dyes and other ingredients of concern from school meals. And some states actually have even, you know, passed these bans. Like West Virginia was the first one to do so at the state level across their entire food supply. And those are really being led by Republicans and in some places are these bipartisan efforts. But to me, that really like doesn't really gel with this whole idea of, okay, we're going to make slightly cleaner, slightly better for you, like very industrial foods. But we're going to also cut money for really getting like unprocessed or very minimally processed nutritious local food into schools and into, you know, other places where families who have a more chronic health burden would be accessing food. So to me, it doesn't make a whole lot of policy sense.
That was Dr. Jennifer Gaddis, Associate Professor of Civil Society and Community Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. If you're just joining us, we're talking about recent cuts to farm-to-school funding from the U.S. Department of Agriculture today here on A Public Affair. I'm talking with Jennifer Gaddis and guests Erica Krug and Caitlin Torjainen, both school nutrition and farm-to-school experts as well. If you have questions or stories to share about farm-to-school and school nutrition programs and their impacts on your family or people you know or your community, give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. That's 608-256-2001, extension 9. Erica, we're going to go back to you now. And tell us a little bit about what this looks like for Rooted on the ground now. You are the director of Farm to School programs and suddenly have learned that this money that you've been counting on and using, is this the first time you've received a grant from this program?
No.
Okay. So yeah, you've been using already. What does that mean for you all and your work at Rooted?
Yeah. So we had applied for the USDA Patrick Leahy grant. We received it in, I believe, 2021. It was a 2-year grant. So that money helped to fund our school garden programming, also supported the Wisconsin School Garden Network, which is another project of Rooted, which helps to connect people across the state to the youth gardening movement. We also promote Wisconsin School Garden Day, which is now an annual event in May with a governor's proclamation. It helped to fund our field trips to our youth garden sites. So we were eligible to apply for that grant again this year, and we had applied. The deadline, I believe, was January 7th. So, we spent a lot of time working on that grant application, and we had several goals with that project. One was that it was going to support our gardener in residence program at partner schools in Madison, including the schools that we work with that have the highest economic disadvantage rates. So schools don't have a lot of extra money, as we know. Our goal is to be able to provide this programming but not have the burden be on the schools. So as much as we can, we try to offset those costs through federal funding and donations. So we were counting on that money to help us provide a gardener in residence at several elementary schools, and we also work with La Follette High School, where we provide a cooking and gardening club, and help also just kind of supplement or offset the cost for other schools that we work with as well. We're also intending to use the money to help us work with a couple of school garden consultants to help create a more equitable school garden program in Madison. That we were going to try to set up like a tiered system. You know, some schools are more resourced than others. So we want to make sure that every school that wants a school garden can have a school garden. We don't want funding to be the barrier, the thing that's stopping that. So we were going to work with school garden consultants to kind of start to set up this system. We were also planning on setting up an advisory committee to support MMSD in getting more local food into school meals. We are now connected to lots of farmers in the area who want to be selling to the school district. We've started to make those connections, and we were going to use this project, this funding, to help build on that. So we received a letter on March 31st telling us that the funding, the grant, had been canceled for this year, in alignment with President Trump's executive order that it was wasteful and wasteful DEI program. So what does that mean for us?
So it was tied to DEI specifically. Sorry to interrupt.
No, that's okay. I have it. Yeah, we received a letter from USDA on March 31st saying, in alignment with President Trump's executive order entitled Ending Radical and Wasteful Government DEI Programs and Preference. So, another thing that just doesn't, that's really hard to grapple with for this is that, we're always being told to talk about how we can incorporate, equity into our projects and everything. And we're, asked to use language to describe those efforts. And so now it's being flagged. And so that's hard, because up until January, this was a, big emphasis of a grant application. And now I feel like it's being turned and used against us. So, but what we're doing is we're getting kids outside and we're teaching them how to grow food, and we're working to support our local, agricultural community so that they have a source of income. Kids are eating local food. In response to this, what we're really doing is leaning into our local community now to try to make sure that this can continue to happen. So without the federal funding this year, we're looking more at local grants. We're also looking more at donors. And for the first year ever, we are doing a fundraiser for our Farm to School programming. So on May 24th at Troy Farm on the north side, we're doing Farm to School Aid, which is going to be a music festival fundraiser. We're going to have four bands and food carts and kids activities. So we're hoping people will come out and support us that way too. But we're really realizing that this is something we know the Madison community wants and supports. So we are working to bring people together and really, you know, being on shows like this and helping to people to understand that this is happening, and really looking to our local community to help support our efforts moving forward, so we're not so reliant on these federal grants.
So it's not existential in the sense of like, oh, the programs are going away necessarily, but does it raise questions about your ability to sustain these programs?
Definitely, okay. Yeah. And you know, we currently do have this other USDA grant that is supporting some of this work. We had heard that had been paused. Fingers crossed. Last week we did find out that they think that application will be opening again. We will be allowed to reapply for that funding sometime in the next few weeks, hopefully. No, this is not the end of Farm to School at Rooted. I just see it as a new chapter, and kind of like looking at more creative ways, more local ways that we can continue this work. It's hard to be reliant on grants. Yep. It's a game, and so I think, you know, if there is any sort of silver lining in any of this, you know, I think that it's causing us to kind of, you know, think about what this programming means to us, means to our communities, and work together to ensure that it happens. And if we can do that locally, then we'll have more control of it. We won't be so reliant on federal grants. So yeah, I think it's causing us to get, you know, more creative with the ways that we can continue working to promote this. But I mean, it 100% has to continue to happen. I mean, it just makes sense to pay our farmers to feed our kids, you know, and to have our kids learn how to grow their own food and to have these opportunities to get outside and be in the sunshine and work together. And so it won't stop, you know, we're going to make sure it continues some way.
Jennifer, I know you'd like to jump in here. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that when we're thinking about this kind of funding, it's not just from this DEI perspective that some of the funding would have maybe been going to some of the schools that would be challenged economically to be doing this programming themselves. But when we think about the local food to schools funding, basically how it worked was the federal government allocated a specific amount to each state, kind of proportional to their population. But the individual states got to decide how they wanted to really prioritize the use of those funds. So for example, we have data that shows that in the state of Illinois, they really prioritized socially disadvantaged farmers. And in Wisconsin, a lot of the funding actually went to new and beginning farmers. So certainly some established farmers as well, but some who maybe would have had harder times getting access to these kinds of markets or the capital that they need to really grow and stabilize their operations. So I think it's really important. You know, some people might say, oh, well, that's DEI. But we really have to think about what does it look like to create a more stable agricultural system in the United States. And we know that the average age of farmers is just increasing, and that we see, you know, so much consolidation of farms, and we really need to be in a place, you know, in terms of domestic food security, where we have more people who see farming as a viable occupation. So the kinds of incentives that this program provided for farmers who maybe didn't have access to other kinds of traditional bank loans, or who really just needed like some stimulus, I think is so important for the future resilience of our food system, and for just making sure that we literally have people to grow food, because like that's not a problem that AI can solve, yeah, for example. So I think that it is important to recognize that states got to decide how this money would be used. And, you know, there was a lot of thought that was put into what would actually make the most sense in terms of really trying to benefit not only these rural populations who maybe would be growing more of the food, but also these places that may be struggling in terms of food access, in terms of the communities and schools' ability to purchase this healthy food.
Thank you, Jennifer. I want to turn back to you as well, Caitlin. Feel free to build on anything you've heard. And also, it'd be great to hear from you also about the impacts of these cuts that you're hearing about from around the state.
Yeah. So I want to reiterate some of the things that were said in the last few minutes here. Dr. Gaddis mentioned how, you know, this was really guaranteed income for farmers. And I think that was really important to note. A huge percentage of farmers are the ones that qualify for free and reduced. But we also have 1 in 6 kids in our state that are food insecure, and 30% of those kids don't qualify for free and reduced, which means some of those farming families were using that income to kind of get them over that burden of not having enough money, which was fantastic for their family. The other scary thing to note is we know that there are so many more people going to food pantries now than there have been in the last few years. And that extra funding for farms to donate or quote unquote donate their food to the pantries was so important for those families that are attending the pantries. We see this in schools. We see it every day. We have families who don't qualify for free and reduced meals that accrue insurmountable negative balances because we're not going to not feed kids, right? So you have a third grade child coming to you and saying, I don't have any money in my account. My mom didn't pack me a lunch. We're not saying like, okay, well, too bad for you. I guess you don't get to eat today. We're making sure that those kids get something in their belly. And a lot of that food that we were using when this LFS money was out was local foods that we were purchasing from our surrounding farmers. And it was a great partnership. So, you know, I think it was said earlier, we're not going to quit farm to school, but there was a comment about some schools being more resourced than others. And I think that that is also super important to note. Some of us, you know, we can overcome this burden and, you know, keep going, pushing as strong as we were before. And some of us just don't have the means to purchase these things. One of the people on our School Nutrition Association of Wisconsin board was working on a partnership with a local farm to bring beef into her school district. And when this funding got cut, she had to call him up and say, I'm sorry, I don't have the funding available to purchase this next year. So when you think about the scale of the beef that we're bringing in, it's not like, you know, somebody is buying 1 or 2 cows and then we say, oh, sorry, we can't buy it. We're feeding 1,600, depending on the school district, you know, anywhere from 1,000 kids to 10,000, 30,000 kids a day. So it's a huge, huge loss. And I don't think people understand the impact that this has both on schools and the families that were receiving this food.
Thank you, Caitlin. I just want to remind listeners that you're listening to A Public Affair on WRT 89.9 FM. My name is Douglas Haynes, and I'm talking today with Caitlin Tarjainen, who is president of the School Nutrition Association of Wisconsin, as well as Erica Krug, farm-to-school director at the Madison nonprofit Rooted, and Jennifer Gaddis, associate professor of civil society and community studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. If you have a question or a story to share about farm-to-school programs, school nutrition, give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. We'd love to have you join the conversation. There's so many different places we could go now. I'm struck in particular by the stress that I'm hearing from many of you about sort of this underlying question of how are these kids going to get fed, and how does this amplify already existing pressures on food security and food insecurity among many families. How does the inflation of food prices contribute to the pressures school nutrition programs and food pantries are facing? This is something a lot of people are thinking about, of course, now. And again, something like cuts to a program that helps connect producers to school nutrition programs can only amplify that, I'm guessing. Jennifer, can we go back to you to talk a little bit about the role of inflation and its convergence with these kinds of cuts?
Sure. I think that part of the broader conversation right now in terms of how inflation would be impacting children and families and their food security isn't really just so much these cuts to getting local food into schools, but is really more so these broader conversations about the Trump administration potentially changing eligibility for free school meals. There's something that I'm sure Caitlin can speak to very effectively called the community eligibility provision. And there have been some proposals that would drastically cut eligibility for basically providing no-cost school meals. And so I think that that's something that as you're kind of changing the eligibility requirements, you know, that's something that makes it to where a lot of those families that Kayla mentioned who may be actually struggling a lot economically, but who don't quite fit the very, very narrow threshold for free and reduced meals, they would be at schools potentially that are able to provide no-cost school meals and, you know, be really helped a lot, especially as they're struggling with inflation. But if we do see these pretty drastic cuts to school meal eligibility, that would make it much more difficult for Wisconsin schools and schools across the country to offer no-cost school meals, I think it's going to have really huge impacts for people who are struggling, but who just don't qualify for free or reduced meals because the thresholds are pretty tight.
Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that, Caitlin?
Sure. So there are a few different ways to qualify for free or reduced meals across this nation and state. One of the ways is filling out an income verification form. So you write down how much you make every month and you submit that in. And if you qualify, I believe this year it's somewhere around $45,000. A family of four making over $45,000 a year doesn't qualify for free meals. And that's before taxes. So imagine all the different expenses we have, and with inflation being what it is right now, that's hard on that family. I look at my family. I have myself and my two daughters, and they're both young, young enough that they don't need a ton of food right now. But I think of my my family growing up with two teenage boys growing up, and then a younger daughter, and the mouths that my parents had to feed at that time. I don't know. I mean, in today's age, $45,000 can't cover all your expenses and feeding your kids healthy food. So parents are forced to make this decision of like, do I send my kid to school and accrue a negative balance and get phone calls every day from the school district bugging me for money? Or do I send my kid to school with a six pack of Quick Trip donuts, which is something I have seen because it costs $1.29 at Quick Trip to buy a six pack of donuts. And that's something you can send because you know your child's going to have some source of food to put in their bellies. Now, we gave that kid a lunch. And guess what happened? We, as a school district, paid for it. But anyway, so the other way, sorry, I got off on a tangent. I can go on for hours.
No, I think that's a powerful example to share.
And the importance of them. But the other way to qualify is called direct certification. And that happens when a family is enrolled in a different state aid program. So whether it be FDIPR or Food Share, sometimes Medicaid can qualify you. So our districts get a list of students that are enrolled in our school district. We match them. They automatically qualify for free or reduced meals. They don't have to fill out an application, and they are covered for the entire school year. Currently, if a school district has 25% of its students qualifying for free or reduced meals through the direct certification process, they qualify for a program called CEP, or Community Eligibility Provision, which means that all students have access to a free, no-cost meal to their family every single day, breakfast and lunch. It's a little bit more nuanced than just saying like, oh, yay, everybody gets fed for free. There is an area where school districts like Ashwaubenon, for instance, I believe we have a 25.8% qualification rate for direct certification. So technically, we could be in that program. However, the government only reimburses you a certain percentage of that. So if I in Ashwaubenon were to enroll in that program, we would lose money out of our food service fund very, very quickly. But there is a little bit of wiggle room in there. So some districts choose that they can afford to do that and their general funds will cover that cost. And some districts have, you know, 55% where it might be feasible for them to do that. The federal government is looking at changing the qualifications to 60%, which means that over 100,000 kids in our state will lose access to free meals. The other important thing to note is when we work on the Healthy School Meals for All campaign in Wisconsin, which is no-cost meals to all students in our state who are participating in the National School Lunch or School Breakfast Program, one of our big talking points for our state is that we would maximize federal dollars. So we would have every school district, including Ashwaubenon, who's at 25.8 or 6 or whatever it ends up being, enrolled in CEP, and then the state would cover those additional expenses. If that changes to 60% federally, that would put a lot more pressure on the states that are already doing no-cost school meals for families, and I think that we would lose any hope we have in Wisconsin of passing this at some point.
So just to paraphrase, make sure I'm understanding you correctly, if the Trump administration does reduce that threshold for qualifying for free school meals, you're saying it would reduce the likelihood that Wisconsin would also get behind as a state the Healthy School Meals for All or providing school meals for all children. Am I understanding correctly, Caitlin?
That's correct. Okay. Yeah. So I just went to about a month ago, I went to Washington, D.C. for the Legislative Action Conference for the National School Nutrition Association. And a lot of the states there that are currently participating in Free Meals for All, there's 8 states currently working on this. They had mentioned that if that CEP threshold increases from 25 to 60%, that they would likely lose their Free Meals for All families because it would be such a huge cost to the state, and they wouldn't be able to carry that burden anymore.
Jennifer, we'll turn back to you, and then I want to make it back to Erica in a minute as well. But so somebody might listen to this and say, well, how can this possibly be true, right? We're in the richest country in the history of the world. Why do we not have money to pay for children to eat food in schools? What's the political landscape around Healthy School Meals for All at this point? How can that shift so that the funding priorities might be more amenable to providing meals for children? I know we've talked about this on this show in the past, Jennifer, so I guess I'm kind of asking, where are we at with that initiative right now in terms of providing meals for everyone in Wisconsin and elsewhere?
I think that we're at a point right now in the United States where there was a lot of growing interest from individual states and from communities that took a look at some of the changes that happened in the Biden administration when they did lower the eligibility threshold for, you know, providing free school meals for your whole community. But all of this really comes down to finances. And so right now, I think we're at a point where the Republicans in the Trump administration really, I think, are pushing for more of this kind of emphasis on personal responsibility, right? Like, so this whole rhetoric around, well, why should taxpayers be supporting children whose parents can't afford to buy them lunch? But I think that that's one of the things that is really not productive or helpful in thinking about school meals, because we don't make those same kinds of questions around other things that schools provide. Like, why shouldn't families be paying for, you know, their English teacher or their math teacher based on household income? So for a really long time, school meals have been treated as this kind of one exceptional thing in schools that we means test. And I think that it's a really problematic thing for a variety of reasons. But even if we're just thinking about, you know, from a fiscally conservative standpoint, trying to save taxpayer dollars, we know from research that this is probably the most impactful site of intervention in terms of public health. So trying to not only shape children's taste preferences and dietary patterns at the population level, but also really it provides this great kind of large enough, but also small enough to make it kind of feasible, kind of training ground for figuring out, like, well, if we really want to change what the American food system and the American food supply looks like, we could do that starting with school meals. So that's why even in some of the states, we're seeing, for example, maybe not like a widespread ban on certain dyes and additives like what West Virginia did, but starting at the school level. And part of the research that I do is actually international. And I think that that's something that we see globally that a lot of countries will do is they'll say, we actually really see potential in our school meal program, especially if it's universally free to all students, as a place that we're not only really trying to promote public health and a different relationship to food, but also as a real leverage point for using public dollars to provide different kinds of incentives to producers and manufacturers and to try to create basically a different food system for people to live in. So I think that we're at a point where, unfortunately, there's still a lot of this, like, just kind of debate around what should be a public versus private responsibility instead of actually thinking about what would be most efficient from an economic standpoint, especially if we think about how much of our healthcare costs would actually be, you know, coming from public resources as well in the future as these kids are aging.
Yeah. That's a great point that the costs aren't just in paying for the meals themselves, but there are all kinds of other costs going on down the line in terms of public health. Caitlin, go ahead. You wanted to build on something Jennifer was just saying.
Yeah. So there was a study that Tufts University did a number of years ago that talks about how school meals are the healthiest food that children receive in a day, which is absolutely true. But they just came out with another one a couple months ago, and it talked about, the state of Massachusetts has offered free school meals for students, and they found that, I'm going to read it right off of their website here, new research from the Tufts University proves that continuing a school meals for all policy can save Massachusetts $152 million in direct medical costs and productivity annually among adults. So to put that in perspective, they're spending roughly $175 million a year on providing free meals and finding $152 million return on investment, which I think is pretty significant, especially knowing that, like Dr. Gaddis said, it really comes down to the dollar and how much it's going to cost each state or federally to provide this. But we're getting this research back that's showing it's making a huge impact on the lives of our adults.
Thank you, Caitlin. That's Caitlin Torjainen, president of Wisconsin, the School Nutrition Association of Wisconsin. You're listening to A Public Affair, and we have about a little more than 10 minutes left today. There's still time to give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. We're talking about farm-to-school programs and Trump administration cuts to farm-to-school programs. And Erica Krug from Rooted, we're going to go back to you now, and by all means, if there's anywhere you want to take it based on what you've heard, that's great. One thing I'll throw out there for you is I know you have a lot of firsthand experience with these benefits that both Jennifer and Caitlin are describing in terms of public health and children engaging with food and growing food too. And so if you have stories to share about that, that's great, but I'll leave it open for you.
Yeah, no, exactly. I did want to build on something that both Jennifer and Caitlin mentioned, and that's that we know that the lunches and the school meals are really nutritious for kids, but we also don't want, you know, that food to end up in the garbage. So if, you know, that's, I think, where that education component of farm to school really comes in, is we also need to teach kids what fruits and vegetables are, where they come from. And I can't remember exactly what the data is, but, you know, there's like kids need to try something 4 to 5 times before they decide if they actually like it. So when we never force kids to try anything, we do a lot of taste tests, but, you know, we'll present like a variety of carrots of different colors or cherry tomatoes. And we encourage them to try them if they'd like to. And then we encourage them to try them again and again, because kids really need to try something a number of times before they decide that they want to eat it. So when we're then presenting those foods on the lunch tray, they're more likely to eat them if it's something that they've had experience with. So that's where that education part of this really comes into play. And then if they've had a hand in growing it, then it's just like exponential that they're going to be excited about eating it. I like to tell the story about the time I was helping out with a field trip at the at our Troy Kids Garden on the north side. It was a kindergarten class who had come to the to our school garden site there, or our kids garden site there, and I saw kids, kindergartners, just like ripping kale leaves off the plant and just eating it, you know, raw right there. And, you know, even, I mean, they hadn't actually even grown that plant, but just to physically be there, see it growing, and to be able to reach out and grab it and try it is really powerful. And that's what gets kids excited about, you know, trying these different fruits and vegetables and understanding where they come from, and having kids be able to pick apples from the tree or get raspberries fresh off the vine. So when they have that experience of actually getting to see where it's growing and meeting the farmers sometimes who grow their food, they're so much more likely to eat that food. So that's like those three components of farm to school really are integral to making sure that this program is successful and that we can continue to do this work, is not just working on getting those local foods into school meals, but then educating around it and also giving kids the experience of growing that food themselves is really integral and so critical for farm to school programming.
I want to talk a little bit about the infrastructure that you've created for that. You've built this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Here in Madison, rooted and working with all these schools. And you mentioned earlier community fundraising, mm-hmm. finding other ways to support this. I feel like before we wrap up today, we should talk a little bit about the state role as well, and whether the Wisconsin state budget, which is in process of being created now, is a place that we can look to for filling in these holes that the Trump administration has created for this kind of work that you're all describing so powerfully. Let's go back to you, Jennifer, and what's your sense of the state budget process and the state budget as being a place that can make up some of the gaps in this federal funding?
Great question. So one thing I wanted to flag just really quickly before moving on to the state piece is that Erica was talking about the really important educational aspects of farm to school. And she mentioned that Rooted has several AmeriCorps volunteers. I think a lot of people around the state who want to do this educational work with their students look to AmeriCorps for volunteers, service members who will do this work. And one of the things that I saw announced last week was a pretty significant impending cut to AmeriCorps. So I think that that's something to kind of keep in mind as well, that we could see cuts up to about 50% at AmeriCorps potentially. So if people really want to preserve the educational piece, I think advocating for preserving those AmeriCorps positions is really important right now. At the state level, you know, Governor Evers has talked about this as being like the year of the kid. So I think really trying to support the things that we see Governor Evers including in the budget, which include not only free school meals for all, which would be for students not only in public schools, but also private schools that participate in the federal child nutrition programs, but also, you know, thinking about how do we actually fully fund some of the farm to school positions and programs that maybe we've had on the books at the state level, but haven't always received like the full amount of funding. I think that there is a huge amount of potential for people across the state, especially those who are in more Republican-leaning districts, to put pressure on their elected officials to really invest in the year of the kid, you know, making sure that all students have access to free school meals, that we're doing things that really benefit not only Wisconsin families, but also Wisconsin's rural communities, which Farm to School does. So I think we actually see right now a great policy opportunity, and Caitlin can speak to this more as one of the leads of the Healthy School Meals for All Coalition, of, you know, people not necessarily having to come up with all the solutions themselves, but really just using their own political voice to push for things that we already see on the table actually happening.
Thanks, Jennifer. Yeah, Caitlin, what would you like people to know about how to support school nutrition programs and farm to school right now?
I think it's so important for people to remember that we are offering so many healthy options for kids, and whether this grant funding is there or not, I mean, obviously it makes a huge impact on how much we're able to purchase locally, but we're still going to provide local foods to the best of our abilities. I think your best chance at advocating for anything to happen on a state level is to just bring up the impact that it's had on farmers and share your personal story about what what the removal of this funding means to you and your family. Statistics are wonderful. I like to live in the world of statistics, but they're not as memorable as a personal story about how this food or these programs have impacted your life.
What can you all tell us, any of you, about what you're hearing from farmers in particular and their concerns about losing these contracts to provide schools and childcare centers and food pantries with food? Anybody want to jump in there?
I can start with that.
Okay, go ahead. Great.
Caitlin, go ahead.
Sure. Then you can go next. I'll pass it to you when I'm done. it's hard for farmers. They have to make their plans years in advance. You know, it's not like you just decide tomorrow that you're going to sell carrots to 75 school districts across the state. You have to know that you need seeds for that. You need equipment for that. You need labor for that. So they were banking on this money coming in, and then all of a sudden the rug got pulled out from underneath them. And fortunately, a lot of seeds are something that they can keep, but there are some that they can't. And so now what are they going to do with all of the stuff that they were going to grow? It's a huge financial loss to them, both in the sense that they purchase things to supply the food to these schools and food banks, and they're not getting the income that they thought they were getting. Jen, I'll throw it over to you.
Thanks, Caitlin. So just building on that, I think to me, one of the most troubling aspects of this is that we have seen really wonderful growth in farm to school over the last two decades. And that's been something that, you know, we see from the National Farm to School Census that the USDA does, that more and more districts are participating in this. But, you know, it's taken a lot of effort for school nutrition directors like Caitlin sometimes to be able to say, we actually want to do things differently. We want to be bringing in food from local producers, not through necessarily our mainline distributor. And we want to maybe be spending money a little bit differently. And I think that because school nutrition departments in Wisconsin are mostly all expected to be financially self-sustaining based on the federal reimbursement dollars and the money that families pay in, it's really challenging when you have a sudden kind of unexpected thing happen financially. And I think similarly for a lot of these farmers, you know, looking at schools, it's like they think it's going to be the stable market because you know kind of the number of people you're going to feed. You know, like that there's 180 days like of the year that you're going to be potentially feeding them. And so when all these things happen that like kind of take all this goodwill and all this trust building that's taken a lot of years and suddenly kind of take it away, I think it makes people more risk averse. And I think that it puts us in a situation where people are much more inclined to just stick with the status quo and, you know, stick with big food, ultra processed food industry, shelf stable commodities instead of really working to build a better food system. And so to me, that's one of the most unfortunate pieces of this. That I think we were really moving in a positive direction, and a lot of people may be in a position where just in the future, when opportunities do arise, they're a little bit more skittish about taking them.
Thank you, Jennifer. We've got about 1 minute left here. Erica, I'm going to give you the last word here in the studio. Anything you want to add in terms of people, how people can engage, or what's keeping you going right now, what you're energetic about still trying to create in these conditions?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I think it's just this idea that we do need to think about our local food system as much as possible. So we found about, you know, we learned that during the pandemic, and I think it's more true than ever. So how can we create a resilient local food system? Right now, I think it's, you know, paying attention to the National Farm to School Network's updates. They're asking people to share their stories. Also, we held a call last week, and we had about 50 people come to talk about the cancellation of these funds. We had a representative from Senator Baldwin's office who said, you know, we want to hear all of this, so share your stories. So just encouraging people to share their stories. You can follow Rooted on social media, on Instagram, on Facebook. We are sharing ways to advocate for farmers and for farm to school all of the time. So I think it's really time to just lean into that network, support each other, and we got this. We'll figure it out. But, you know,
thank you, Erica.
We need to spread the word. So, yeah, thank you.
That's Erica Krug with the Madison nonprofit Rooted. Thanks for being here. And we've also had with us Caitlin Turiainen, President of the School Nutrition Association of Wisconsin. Thank you, Caitlin. And thanks again for coming back, Jennifer Gaddis from UW-Madison. It was great to have you all here today. If you've appreciated the show today, please share it on the Wart Online Archive or wherever you find your podcasts. I want to give a shout out to engineer Andrew Thomas, producer Sarah Gabler, news director Shelley Pittman, and receptionist Amy Lutsky. And thank you, listeners, for joining us today on A Public Affair here at WRT 89.9 FM Madison. Stay tuned for Madison Bookbeat. With information that would never be reported. Disregard
the mainstream media. Hello, I'm David Harper with the BBC News. Tens of thousands of people have fled Sudan's largest refugee camp in Darfur after RSF paramilitaries took control following days of violence. Zamzam camp has been providing a temporary home to 500,000 people. Doctors Without Borders say the civilians have moved to the town of Tawila. The RSF launched an aerial and ground assault across the western Darfur region over the weekend. The United Nations told the French news agency that their office had verified nearly 150 killings, but there were likely to be more than 400 dead. Our Africa correspondent Mayeni Jones reports.